Let's see, now this is a case called Phillips Investment versus the State of Colorado. Could I have the interview appearances, please?
May it please the court, Edward Lyons, Justice Gallagher, here for the petitioner.
Thank you, Mr. Lyons. And for the U.S. Attorney's Office, or excuse me, your Attorney General's Office.
You promoted me here.
Not really.
Paul Chesson, from the Colorado Attorney General's Office, here on behalf of the respondents in the State of Colorado and the Administrator of the Uniform Consumer Credit.
Thanks very much. General, this is an hour case that needs each of you about half an hour. If you wish to reserve some time, you need to do so yourself. And you may go ahead, Mr. Lyons.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. The background facts are simple and undisputed. Tulips is a Delaware limited liability company having its principal place of business in Ocean View, Delaware. It was engaged in making short-term consumer loans from that location. Tulips never maintained an office or had an employer agent in Colorado. This case arose when the Attorney General served an investigatory subpoena out of state on Tulips in Delaware, commanding it to produce documents to the Attorney General in Colorado. When Tulips did not comply, the state then obtained ex parte orders, first enforcing the subpoena and subsequently citing Tulips for contempt. These orders were also served out of state on Tulips in Delaware. Tulips then and its special appearance moved to dismiss on grounds of court by subject matter jurisdiction. The district court granted that motion. The district court also took pains to point out that the state had another way to obtain records under the Uniform Interstate Deposition and Discovery Act. The decision of the Court of Appeals that allowed the stand would impermissibly grant the state a unique immunity from the long-standing rule of state sovereignty announced and followed in no less than four decisions of this court, most recently in Colorado Mills, decided only 2 years ago. The rule of court states that no state court or government has authority beyond its own borders, each state being sovereign as to its own territory and those residing therein. And Colorado courts therefore have no authority to compel compliance with other state subpoenas directed to non-parties. The decision of the Court of Appeals would render the rule inapplicable through an investigatory subpoena issued by the state. This should not be allowed to happen.
That's a really broad statement. Would you mean, surely you accept the notion of long-arm jurisdiction, something along those lines?
At a different stage, if we had gotten to that stage, then yes, long-arm jurisdiction would have applied to a lawsuit brought by the state. But that hasn't happened, and so long-arm jurisdiction I don't believe is implicated.
And so the broad statement you made about sovereignty within its borders intended to allow for other bases for jurisdiction despite territorial boundaries.
Oh, absolutely. No, I understand. You're absolutely right, Justice Coates. Yes. And my point is this, that Solidate, the cases that followed it, including Colorado Mills, all dealt with the subpoena power. In Colorado Mills, this court expressly rejected the notion that subpoena power can be extended territorially based on long-arm principles of jurisdiction. I believe that's the distinction.
And could I hear that?
I just spoke too broadly.
No. I just wanted to make clear where we were, what we were all agreed on here.
Absolutely.
The one other thing was you started off by talking about not doing business in the state. And are you contesting then that the state would have personal jurisdiction over your client?
Your Honor,
or does that make any difference?
No, I don't argue for you. Honestly, I don't believe it makes any difference at this time. I represent this company only in connection with this litigation. I have no way of knowing all of the details that would be necessary to make an assessment of whether long-arm jurisdiction would apply to a suit. But again, that's a matter, I think, that's left necessarily for another day.
Well, counsel, let me just follow up with that, though. I mean, just to get you to respond to the state's argument, which is, if you can sue, you can subpoena.
I'm sorry, Justice Ida.
Can I get you to respond to the state's argument that basically, if you can sue, you can subpoena?
If you can sue, you can subpoena?
Mm-hmm. If your client could be sued, that power kind of necessarily includes the power to subpoena.
I don't think any of the jurisprudence supports that. Historically, in this state, for more than a decade now, this court has steadfastly adhered to a rule that out-of-state enforcement of a non-party subpoena requires the assistance of the state in which the discovery is to take place. The question of whether the state could acquire long-arm jurisdiction in a lawsuit is not what's involved in the case. As I said earlier, I believe, is a question that has to be left for another day. I hope I'm not missing the point.
But no, I appreciate your answer to that. I just wanted you to respond directly to that argument. And essentially, I guess you're saying that the long-arm jurisdiction and the power to sue doesn't necessarily include the subpoena power. That's different.
Well, that is the difference, I believe, Your Honor, yes.
Thank you.
Are you finished, Justice Ida? I'm sorry. So it's true, though, isn't it, that Soliday and Colorado Mills, those cases don't involve statutorily authorized pre-litigation investigative subpoenas. Isn't this a kind of special statutory proceeding that falls outside of the ambit of Rule 45?
Your Honor, I don't believe there's anything in the four decisions that this court has entered on this subject that suggests that the rule of state sovereignty applies only in the absence of a statute saying otherwise. The existence of the statutes in this case that allow the Attorney General or the Administrator to conduct investigations, issue investigatory subpoenas and so forth, are not above, out of the scope of the rule of sovereignty that this court has talked about for more than 50 years. I can't see any basis for conferring a special, unique immunity status on state officials simply because of their statute of their rules.
Can you help us understand, remind us of your argument about the compare Silverman footnote in Colorado Mills, and speak to the issue of why you think Silverman's approach is misguided? Give me with, please.
Well, I will, Your Honor, and thanks for that opportunity. The Silverman case, of course, was mentioned at the conclusion of this court's with footnote 4 in the court's opinion in Colorado Mills. And as I pointed out in the briefs, that footnote applied to a sentence in the court's opinion that had to do with the Colorado long-arm statute, as well as long-arm statutes of other states, not applying to subpoena enforcement. Somehow or other, that got misapplied to the following sentence in the court's opinion, which pointed out the rule that has been steadfastly enforced, and that is that such enforcement, if any, of an out-of-state non-party subpoena is necessarily left to the state in which the discovery is to take place. And when this court footnoted with a compare signal, I don't think, I disagree at least, with the state's argument that somehow or other suggests an endorsement by this court in Colorado Mills of Silverman's regime resulting in Silverman. In that case, here's my notes on Silverman. In that case, the
the court actually seems to, the Sullivan Court, the Jersey Court, actually seems to be saying, and this is how Justice, this is how the opinion was reported, Colorado Mills interpreted it in Sullivan, is that the, if a statute, in that case, the court found that the statute did grant the administrator authority to conduct investigations within and outside the state. The court then reasoned that the courts of New Jersey could take actions to, in relative to enforcing that subpoena, that would be entitled to full faith and credit. And that's what the Footnote 4 actually mentions, that, that those efforts to enforce an out-of-state subpoena would be achieved through other states according full faith and credit to New Jersey's orders. But that just gets back to the same thing, that you, it, there's no limiting scope power, judicial power, in a Colorado court to reach out into another state and order compliance with a subpoena. There is, of course, a clear avenue to accomplish that under, among other things, the Uniform Administration Depositions and Discovery Act, or as those who practice, even less years than I have, understand, there's a time-tested procedure under Rule 28C to obtain letters of rogatory or a commission to enlist the assistance of a sister state.
I'm having trouble with your sovereignty argument because I thought that's exactly what the state's doing here, is protecting its sovereignty and protecting its citizens. And do you deny that your client is doing business in Colorado?
This company, I don't know, is even any longer doing business, Your Honor. It's not, I don't, as I said.
Or did business? I mean.
Did, obviously, the Attorney General had evidence that, based on a complaint of a Colorado resident, that she had entered into a loan transaction with Tulips and was complaining about the way that loan was being administered. But, Your Honor, with all respect, I think it's a red herring to look at this case as if the only way that the state can investigate an apparent or alleged violation of state law is to issue a subpoena, serve it out of state on a non-party, and then have a Colorado court with its power of contempt enforce that subpoena. It's a false dilemma, because the UIDDA does provide a mechanism by which not the administrator's subpoena, Your Honor, but the court, the order of the Colorado court, Colorado District Court, is by definition a foreign subpoena enforceable under the UIDDA in Delaware as well as in Colorado.
So, but may or may not be, but we're dealing with a statute that authorizes what happened here, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We're dealing with a statute that authorizes this free investigative subpoena?
Yes, 5-6-106 has three parts. Part 1 authorizes the administrator to conduct investigations. Part 2 provides a procedure where its records are located outside the state. A party that can be served with a subpoena has an option of how to produce them. And then Part 3 provides the enforcement mechanism under the UCCC. Part 3 would be meaningless if Part 2 of the statute implied the power, as the Court of Appeals concluded it did. I think, you know, that's such an important perspective. Whether, as I believe, the rule of sovereignty has been recognized consistently for more than a half century is a doctrine of constitutional law or not. Certainly, state sovereignty
is inherent. It's a creature of the structure of the United States, the Constitution of the United States, and it's a cornerstone of American federalism. But this court doesn't have to decide this case based on constitutional grounds, because the truth is, the statute that the state relies upon and the Court of Appeals recognized does not purport to abrogate in any way this long-standing rule. Whether it's a rule of constitutional proportions, it's certainly part of the established, the well-established, firmly established common law of this state, this rule of individual state sovereignty. A legislative intent to attempt to abrogate that has to be clearly expressed, and it hasn't been. One of the things that I would encourage the court to do is to look at, first of all, recall that the subpoena in this state, the subpoena in this case, excuse me, was issued not by the administrator, but by the attorney, in the name of the attorney general. That's in the record at page 7 of the electronic branch. An attorney general's subpoena is governed by a statute that specifically provides that a service, that a subpoena issued by the attorney general may be served in accordance with the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure, which of course means only within the territorial bounds of the state of Colorado. Now, the Court of Appeals didn't reach this question. It ignored the fact that the subpoena in question was actually issued under a statute that makes it plain that the subpoena cannot be served outside the state.
Counsel, can I interrupt you for just a moment right there? Because I seem to recall in the state's answer brief a footnote that suggests that the subpoena actually issued under both the administrator and the attorney general. And so, and then cited both the Title V provision for the UCCC and the Title VI provision for the attorney general under the Consumer Protection Act.
Your Honor, the subpoena, I have a copy here. It's as I say, at ID 7. The first sentence, the preamble of the subpoena, recites that documents are being requested in connection with an investigation pursuant under the authority of the Uniform Consumer Credit Code and Uniform Consumer Protection Act. No question. And there's no question in my mind that both the administrator, who works, who's an assistant attorney general, and the attorney general were investigating the same conduct. And the jurisdiction, their jurisdiction under those two acts, the UCCC and the CCPA, does overlap. But here's the critical part. The subpoena then goes on and is issued in the name of John Southers, attorney general. So I think it is clear that, well, I think the subpoena was an attorney general subpoena. But the point is, Your Honor, it doesn't make any difference, because if the subpoena was issued, in fact, in the name of, by the administrator of the UCCC, that state officer has no more authority than the attorney general to reach out and serve a subpoena in Delaware and then qualify a Colorado court to invoke the judicial power of the state to order the non-resident to comply with that subpoena, failing which to face contempt of court.
Can I just, I'm going to see if I can follow track your argument, so let me see if I can break it down. Under the Title VI provision, the Colorado Consumer Protection Act, your statutory argument is there's a provision in there that sort of incorporates the rules of civil procedure, including Rule 45, which would be limited to the boundaries of Colorado. The Title V provision under the UCCC doesn't have a cross-reference to the rules of civil procedure, so it's not bound, at least under the plain language of the statute. But you would say, even if it doesn't matter, because in the Colorado Mills, there's no authority beyond the words of Colorado to issue that subpoena. Is it? Am I tracking your argument thus far?
You are doing, yes, okay. Your Honor, you are.
And so here's my question, though, for you. It seems to me that Colorado Mills and that line of case law all has to do with judicial subpoenas that essentially are issued under Rule 45 and under the terms of 45, Rule 45 are limited to the boundaries of Colorado. But the statute here, I mean, this particular subpoena isn't a judicial subpoena. It's an investigative administrative subpoena. The source of the authority for that is this Title V provision. So why is that necessarily bound by the rule of the Colorado Mills?
Well, there's nothing. If it is a rule of law, whether of constitutional importance or simply the established common law of the well-established common law of the state, there's no basis for singling out. Why should the Attorney General be any different than any other litigant? We all have to deal with obtaining testimony and documents from out of state non-parties by using letter of laboratory or Rule 28C or the UIDBA in states that have adopted the UIDBA. But the question, Your Honor, is if the legislature intended to have to make that rule inapplicable, that rule is solid, inapplicable to a state officer, it should have said so. You can't, I don't believe respectfully, you can get to that conclusion by implying that intent from the ambiguous language of subsection 2 of 56106. That section is simple. If you look at Article 2 of the UCC that deals with the regulation of licensed lenders, the statute in that part contains an identical provision, a substantially identical provision, allowing a party served with a subpoena whose records are located out of the state, the option of whether to produce them within or without outside the state. The drafters of the UCC simply carried the same provision forward into Article 6 dealing with administration. But if you go another step, the very next section of Article of the UCCC, 56107, provides that the State Administrative Procedure Act applies to administrative actions of the administrator. The issuance of a subpoena, it seems to me, is quintessentially an administrative action under the statute. The State Administrative Procedure Code clearly requires clearly provides that a subpoena can only be served in accordance with the rules, in the same fashion that a subpoena issued by a district court would be served in a non-party. In other words, within the state. It appears that I have less than 8 minutes left. So unless there's any question that I should address now, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You may do so, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chesson?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The Colorado Legislature charged the state with a mission to enforce Colorado's consumer lending and consumer protection laws. In order to fulfill this mission, the legislature delegated to the state the authority to investigate and subpoena those who may violate those laws. The legislature further told the state what to do in the event a subpoenaed party disobeyed a subpoena. It told the state, go to Colorado's courts to seek an order enforcing the subpoena. Similarly, the legislature empowered the Colorado courts with the authority to hear and entertain these subpoena enforcement cases. Now, Tulips contends that this court's decisions in Soledad and Colorado Mills deprive the Colorado courts of this very same subject matter jurisdiction. It contends the principles of federalism and sovereignty mandate this result. To be sure, both Soliday and Colorado Mills talk about sovereignty, but they also implicate, or certainly Tulips suggests, that they implicate the principle of subject matter jurisdiction, and they also implicate the principle of personal jurisdiction. So I want to talk about these three principles: sovereignty, subject matter jurisdiction, and personal jurisdiction. And then I'll apply these three principles to this case and show how they will lead this case, or else I'll lead this court to the result that you reach in this case. And then I'll show how Soliday and Colorado Mills fit within the framework of these three principles. So first, sovereignty. What is sovereignty? Simply, it's autonomy, or the right of self-governance. Stated another way, it's the right of the people to make laws and be ruled by them. Sovereignty carries with it a mutual obligation that one sovereign will respect the dignity of another sovereign. And this respect also means that the courts of one sovereign will not interfere with another sovereign's acts and conduct within that other sovereign's territory. And certainly so, there is a territorial component to sovereignty. No state can legislate for another or project its laws across state lines so as to regulate conduct within the other state. So what does this mean? Simply, it means that Colorado is free to enact laws, say, regarding speed limits on its highways, or, as Justice Hobbs said, to enact consumer protection and consumer lending laws that regulate conduct occurring in Colorado. It also means that Colorado cannot enact speed limits, say, for Nebraska highways, and similarly, Nebraska can enact speed limits for Colorado highways. Similarly, what the sovereignty means is that if a Coloradan were to, say, go to Nebraska and drive upon the Nebraska Supreme Court stairs, it has to comply with Nebraska law. Similarly, a Nebraska who comes to Colorado and drives on Colorado highways has to comply with Colorado. So that's basically sovereignty. Let's also talk about subject matter jurisdiction. What is subject matter jurisdiction? Subject matter jurisdiction concerns whether a case is the type of case that the court has been empowered with the authority to entertain. Is there a territorial aspect of subject matter jurisdiction, not according to the Colorado Constitution's plain language? Article 6, Section 9.1 provides that Colorado's district courts are courts of general jurisdiction with jurisdiction over all civil cases. Nowhere does this article contain a territorial limit, and so this court back in 1891 so held. In the case of Fletcher v. Stowe, it said no territorial limit is fixed by the Constitution to the civil jurisdiction of the district courts. Instead, as this court has held on multiple occasions, subject matter jurisdiction is broad and sweeping. Now, sovereignty is distinct from subject matter jurisdiction. Sovereignty is not subject matter jurisdictional. It does not concern a court's power to adjudicate. So that's the difference between sovereignty and subject matter jurisdiction. Now let's also talk about personal jurisdiction. Personal jurisdiction is the court's exercise of authority over a person, i.e. the power to compel that person. Now does sovereignty operate as a limitation on a court's personal jurisdiction? No, it does not. And the U.S. Supreme Court made this abundantly clear in the Insurance Corporation of Ireland case. There, it expressly rejected sovereignty as a limitation of a court's judicial power over non-residents. It said there that the personal jurisdiction requirement represents a restriction on judicial power, not as a matter of sovereignty, but as a matter of individual liberty. To be sure, there is a territorial component to personal jurisdiction. International shoes, minimum contacts requirement. But this requirement derives from the due process clause and not from any sovereignty concerns. As the
counsel, I know you want to continue, but I'm going to just stop you there. I appreciate your introduction, but how does that, if where you're going is that there's no territorial component other than sovereignty. How do you explain Colorado Mills? I know we were going to get to that, but we didn't say all that in Colorado Mills. So how is your framework consistent with Colorado Mills?
All right. It's simple, Your Honor. First, in Colorado Mills, we're dealing with an arbitral subpoena. Say that 10 times.
Yes, you did once.
With witnesses who are not subject to Colorado's personal jurisdiction. I think one was a California witness and one was a North Dakota witness. Thus, the court in Colorado Mills lacked personal jurisdiction over these two witnesses. Second, the court was dealing with a statute that specifically confined enforcement of an arbitral subpoena.
Can I stop you on the
first? Sure.
Did we say that there was a lack of personal jurisdiction?
I believe you did, Your Honor. I believe because you did go through this long-arm analysis, and you said that long-arm jurisdiction was lacking over it, but at least certainly that's what I read. But as I was saying, the case also turned on this operative language of the particular statute that restricted enforcement of the subpoena there to enforcement of a judicial civil action subpoena, i.e. a Rule 45 subpoena and its territorial limitations. Now it is true that in Colorado Mills, the court said that as a matter of state sovereignty, Colorado courts have no authority to enforce civil subpoenas against out-of-state non-parties and inside the solid. But with all due respect, I think that might have been a slight overstatement of what Solidate actually did. Because Solidate did not lay down a blanket rule that prohibited that Colorado courts can't enforce subpoenas upon non-residents. So now would be a good time. So let's talk about what's going on in Solidate. As if that because obviously Colorado Mills. So in Solidate, you had a case that was pending in Colorado, litigation in Colorado. They wanted to take the deposition of an Oklahoma citizen. So they obtained from the Colorado court a deadness, brought that deadness to the Oklahoma court, and the Oklahoma court issued a subpoena to the Oklahoma citizen. When the Oklahoma citizen didn't comply with the subpoena, the litigants went back to the Colorado court and said, please enforce this Oklahoma court subpoena. And the court of Solidate said no for two reasons. Number one, let me get my quote, it said that as long established general rule of law, not requiring the citation of authority, that no state court or government has authority beyond its own borders, each state being sovereign as to its own territory and those residing under it. Simply, this is a restatement of sovereignty, that no state can legislate for another or project its laws across state lines. That's all that spoke is. And out of respect, which is this mutual obligation that I was saying, to out of respect for Oklahoma's sovereignty and Oklahoma's sovereign interest in having its own courts enforcing its own subpoenas, it said, we're not going to interfere. We're not going to interfere with an Oklahoma court's enforcement of its own subpoena. And secondly, there was also no personal jurisdiction over the Oklahoma citizen. And the court went into a personal jurisdiction analysis as well. So for two reasons, this sovereignty interest that this is an Oklahoma court subpoena that we're not going to interfere with, and because there was a lack of personal jurisdiction, you can't come to a Colorado court to enforce
it. So why do you think we can get into personal jurisdiction if we have this whole sovereignty concern? I mean, isn't the personal jurisdiction long-arm analysis by way of limitation?
It's certainly the due process.
Sure. And so if you don't have long-arm jurisdiction, why do we even worry about sovereignty? It seems to me like the test is stated backwards.
You shouldn't. And in this case, there are no sovereign interests, except as Justice Hobbs said earlier, the sovereignty of Colorado as an exercise of its police power should be able to protect the health, welfare, and safety of its citizens, the people who come into Colorado and make loans to Colorado citizens. That's the only sovereign interest at play.
I think Justice Hyde asked opposing counsel early on in the argument whether whether it was his position or whether he understood your position to be, that if you have personal jurisdiction, you can issue a subpoena. Do you think that's just oversimplistic? And maybe I'm just totally misquoting you in any event, but...
Well,
I mean, does it really just boil down to that?
For the purpose of an investigative subpoena, yes, there's no territorial limitation built into the statute that authorizes the state to issue an investigative subpoena. Different considerations say that the judicial...
So that seems to actually be the position of the amicus and of the other attorney generals from around the United States.
I believe so, and I think that's consistent with the state's position here, too.
Yes, so if that's the case, then what's the fight here, really? Just whether or not there's personal jurisdiction over tulips in Colorado? Then what is your... You think that there's not a fight, but how did you ever show that there was personal jurisdiction?
Well, actually, personal jurisdiction has not been contested in this case. And in our showing to the district court, in both the application to enforce the subpoena and the evidence that we submitted, we have a consumer complaint, that the consumer obtained a loan, the money was deposited into the consumer, the loan proceeds were deposited into the consumer's Colorado bank account, the money was electronically withdrawn from the consumer's Colorado bank account to a solicited loans in Colorado by the independent. So yes, we think there is enough here, at least to show the threshold, the very low threshold, under our Organic Act.
Sure,
for investigation.
I'm just trying to figure this out. So if they had filed a motion to quash in Colorado, Colorado courts would have then had to determine whether it was personal jurisdiction.
If that was one of the contentions that they made, that there was no personal jurisdiction. And then we could, I suppose, we would have a fight over that.
Okay. Thank you. Yes. That helps.
But they did none of that, right?
They did none of that. That's correct. They contested subject matter.
So it's really over whether the authority has the court has the authority to use the contempt power.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the first part.
The issue is whether the court had authority to use the contempt power.
Well, that's not how it was framed. That's not how the district court framed. The district court said, in essence, that the dealt with whether it had this. Although this issue arose in the context of a contempt proceeding, the district court basically said, I lack subject matter jurisdiction over the underlying subpoena enforcement order.
Okay.
And so that was where the issue was, whether the underlying subpoena enforcement order, that was the subject matter jurisdiction. And the district court said, I lack that subject matter jurisdiction.
Okay. And you think erroneously?
And we think erroneously. Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
And if you're going to say so very quickly, what is the subject matter jurisdiction that gives rise to this court's jurisdiction?
The subject matter jurisdiction is that the legislature told the state where to go. Basically, expressly conferred subject matter jurisdiction by telling the state
over these kinds of claims.
Over these kinds of cases.
In this state. And so assuming that someone, we have personal jurisdiction over someone who we alleged violated this kind of claim, which gives rise to subject matter jurisdiction in our state, we should be able, according to you, to subpoena them, right?
I'm sorry, I lost track.
Okay, and assuming that there is personal jurisdiction in our state, and the claim is filed pursuant to an act which gives the court subject matter jurisdiction, we should therefore be able to subpoena.
Absolutely. Subject matter jurisdiction exists in the court over the subpoena enforcement case. Personal jurisdiction exists over the target of the subpoena. So yes, both of those elements are present, and therefore the court can issue an order or can certainly adjudicate the merits of the subpoena, and if appropriate, issue an order enforcing the subpoena.
And subject matter is just the cause of action. The fact that there is such a cause of action in Colorado, or an allegation of violation, or an offense, or whatever, that arises under the statutes of Colorado, it's that simple, isn't it?
We believe so. That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Now, the trial judge said that there was not subject matter jurisdiction.
Correct.
And didn't get to the issue of personal jurisdiction.
Correct.
All right. And can you help me understand, I know you disagree with it, but can you help me understand her reasoning?
The motion, there was no motion brought contesting personal jurisdiction.
No, but the subject matter.
That's right. The motion that was brought, that was brought with simply a, was limited to a 12B1 motion. They did not bring a 12B2 motion. So there was no issue before the court on personal jurisdiction. Basically, it was conceded.
Right. And I'm perhaps not making my question very clear. So it was a 12B motion, 12B1 motion, no evidence was taken. Judge Rappaport, I think it was, right?
It was Judge Rappaport.
Judge Rappaport granted that motion, didn't have a hearing, said, and correct me when I'm wrong here. I don't think I have it yet, but do so if I am wrong. And at that particular point, she just issued a written order, is that correct, saying no subject matter jurisdiction? What? Tell me what happened. This is where I get pretty confused, obviously.
All right, then there was a subpoena enforcement order that was initially entered.
Yes.
And that was served upon Tulips. Tulips did not comply.
Right.
Therefore, a contempt proceeding was commenced. And in response to that contempt proceeding, Tulips filed a Rule 12B1 motion saying that the subpoena enforcement order was lacking subject matter jurisdiction.
Right.
Judge Rappaport agreed, said the subpoena, if I lack subject matter jurisdiction to issue that subpoena enforcement order. So absent that subpoena enforcement order, everything fell apart. Does that help?
Yes.
Mr. Chesson, she didn't really cite authority specifically. She just said it was based on general subpoena enforcement principles.
That's correct. She did not cite either the code provision that told the state where to go or the CPA provision. She did not cite those statutes at all.
And she said, besides, there's another way you can do this.
That's correct. She referred to the UIDDA.
So I'm getting the impression the order that she entered was brief.
Yes.
Thank you.
I believe it's a two-page order. It's a two-page order that you can find on page 177 of the record.
Okay, thank you.
And basically, you know, using her recollection, she's basically referring to the civil rule, basically.
Well, she did refer to...
Yeah, well, what's she thinking? I mean, you know, she didn't express it, but she's thinking that's the normal practice.
She, I think she's thinking in a Rule 45.
Yeah.
I think that's what she's thinking, yes. I mean, to give her the benefit of the doubt, yes.
Mr. Chesson, turning back to the source of the subject matter jurisdiction, and I question your opposing counsel about these two statutory provisions, one under the UCCC and one under the Consumer Protection Code or Protection Act. To me, at least, there seems to be a difference between the two in that 6.1.108, which gives the Attorney General authority to issue subpoenas under the Consumer Protection Act, makes reference to service or a notice of subpoena may be made in a manner prescribed by law or the common rules of civil procedure. And tell me why you think that isn't sort of like the common law situation where you're talking about a statute that seems to incorporate Rule 45 and its limitations.
All right, certainly. And you're looking at Section 6-1-108,
Sub 2.
It says service may be made in the manner, and the operative word there is manner. Manner means how to do something.
And does manner not include the territorial limits of Rule 45?
Well, how? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Just explain why the territorial limits would not be.
How means, for example, as Professor Wasserman states in her article and the dictionary definition of how means the method. Would be, for example, under Rule 4, whether you serve it personally, service by mail, substituted service, that's manner. It does not mean where. So this section, the way does not have any territorial limitations on it. It just says how you're supposed to serve. For example, on a corporation, you serve it on a registered agent.
So in other words, the reference to common rules of civil procedure, except for the territorial limits in Rule 45.
Well, it also refers to Rule 4. And Rule 4 allows extraterritorial service of the summons.
Okay.
So it's not territorial. I don't think that provision is territorial in it.
Does Rule 81 have any application in that it addresses special statutory proceedings?
Yes, this is a special statutory proceeding. A subpoena enforcement proceeding is a special statutory proceeding. So as this court said in the Orca case, for example, and I think also in the Fagan case, Colorado rules of civil procedure don't apply precisely to this context. So it would have some definition. So, I've talked about Soloway, I've talked about Colorado Mills, we can talk about this case as well. The sovereignty principle, as I said before, is basically that Colorado is free to enact, as it has here, consumer protection, consumer lending laws. No suggestion has been made in this here that Colorado cannot enact those laws, nor has Tulips argued. At least not that I'm aware of, that these laws don't apply to this Colorado loan making. There is certainly subject matter jurisdiction we discussed exists here, and personal jurisdiction too exists.
Could I?
Sure.
You're getting down close enough before you run too far out of time. Could I just shift us for a minute? You haven't commented on, and did you intend to abandon, or do you want to say anything about your argument that we shouldn't be here at all because it's not a defense to a contempt proceeding that that the underlying order was erroneous?
That's a plain preclusion argument, Your Honor.
Right.
We're not abandoning it, but I didn't want to spend time on it. I think it's pretty much set forth in the briefs. However, certainly we think that the subpoena enforcement order was a final judgment, final appealable judgment. There were findings, the court made findings of personal and subject matter jurisdiction. That order was not appealed, our argument is that in a subsequent collateral contempt proceeding, under the policy of finality, those findings are binding. We're not abandoning that.
That argument comes at the end of your brief, and you hadn't mentioned it here. Am I right in understanding that argument would dispose of the case if we were to rule in your favor?
Your Honor, I thought about this, and I think you're correct. However, what that would mean is we may have to be here again arguing the same issues.
And so are you abandoning your argument?
I don't know that I have authority to do that. Perhaps.
You're
perhaps
not abandoning it, you're just asking us not to rule in your favor, is that right?
No, you're not. No, you're not. I don't know how this court is going to rule. And if, you know, it is another argument that, for example, if the court disagrees with us on the big issue, but maybe we would win on the little issue, but we certainly would like the big issue to decide.
Okay.
I don't know how better to put it.
Okay, thank you.
Perhaps a concurrence opinion would work in that society. I also have.
But you think you're right as a matter of law that you can't collaterally attack a contempt order. That is, you have to challenge the order and have it disposed of before you can violate it. Is that right?
Well, we think that you, yes, if you haven't undertaken the administration of justice, the orderly administration of justice requires that you're aggrieved by an order. You have to do something about that order in the proper time. You can't wait later on when you're being potentially subject to punishment for disobeying that order. At that time, you cannot challenge the underlying order. So that's all I'm thinking.
But your preference would be we set aside that consideration and address the merits as long as we're going to rule in your favor.
That would be correct. That's absolutely correct, John. Absolutely correct. I also haven't addressed the UIDDA argument, and we think that is also easily disposed of. It only applies to discovery in civil actions. It does not apply to regulatory agency pre-litigation administrative investigations. So in conclusion, the legislature, again, personal jurisdiction over tulips exists. The legislature expressly conferred subject matter jurisdiction in the Colorado courts to adjudicate the state's cases that it brings to enforce its investigative powers. And then if the state could sue tulips, and tulips now denies that the state can't sue tulips, then this would be absurd to construe the same statutory regimes that give the state the authority to sue, to say that, well, it can't investigate pre-suit. In other words, that it cannot aim first and shoot later. No, we think the Court of Appeals got it right, and we've asked that you return to the Court of Appeals. If there are no other questions?
No. What about Silverman? Should there be anything beyond what the Court of Appeals has done, or just affirm the Court of Appeals on the same grounds?
Well, we think the analysis in Silverman and the other cases that we've cited basically all say that this is really a matter of personal jurisdiction, and that's it.
Saying the same thing essentially in different ways.
That's correct.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Chesson. Mr. Lyons?
Thank you very much. I want to briefly touch on three arguments. Number one, Colorado Mills. Colorado Mills is controlling, I believe, in the present case. Colorado Mills squarely holds that the long-arm jurisdiction provided by statute, long-arm jurisdiction over a cause of action does not apply to subpoena enforcement. I mean, I know there's no reason to read the court's decision, but the court was at pains to point out, this court pointed out, that the Colorado long-arm statute provides a court with the power for a summons to be issued in a civil action on account of certain activities performed by the defendant within this jurisdiction. And as this court pointed out, a subpoena is not a cause of action. This is pre-suit. The whole issue, I think, of personal jurisdiction is a phantom in this case. Even the Silverman Court didn't ultimately ground its decision on the long-arm statutes of the state of New Jersey. It relied on long-arm principles of long-arm jurisdiction in, analysis of the international issue and all of the cases that have come since then. But it ended up really saying, as this court pointed out in footnote 4 when it cited Silverman with the comparison rule, that case stands for the proposition that the New Jersey court would expect another jurisdiction in which the target of the subpoena was a resident to accord full faith and credit to the order. That still, of course, suggests, does it not, that in the ultimate end, in order to get the records, you've got to go to Delaware. Or in the Silverman case, you had to go to New York and expect a New York court with jurisdiction over that resident to enforce the subpoena. But the basis of this court's holding, at least as we understand it, is squarely that a subpoena cannot be enforced extraterritorially under the long-arm statute because a subpoena is not a cause of action. The court couldn't have said it plainer. The long-arm statute does not apply. It didn't apply to the service of a subpoena there, out of state, and it doesn't apply anymore to the service.
Well, that was on witnesses that had no contact with Colorado, right? Am I forgetting something?
I'm sorry.
Am I forgetting something that had to do with people that weren't doing business in Colorado?
I'm not sure.
In the Mills case.
In the Mills case? Yeah. In the Mills case, The two companies there were doing business with the parties in the case, yes.
And that had to do with the rule on subpoenas, right? I mean, isn't that what we were addressing? I'm trying to get oriented what we really did in that case.
Well, I've spent a lot of time, because I do truly believe that this court left nothing undecided that we've talked about here today, with the possible exception of whether a subpoena issued by a state officer under the statutes we're talking about stands on a different footing than a subpoena issued by a private party as consolidated by the and again, the private party in the state of Minnesota case, and a criminal subpoena in Arellano Vila, and an arbitrary subpoena in Colorado Mills. So the question really comes down here, Nero, is there some basis here for creating an exception to the rule in Colorado Mills? And I respectfully submit that this, the if there is a basis, it would have to be implied from, just as the Court of Appeals did, from 5-6-106, subsection 2. That doesn't say anything about service to subpoena. It doesn't say anything about enforcement of the subpoena. It simply provides a procedure for producing records that are located outside the state when the subpoena is lawfully served. I'd also like briefly to comment on Judge Rappaport's decision, which is at page 177 of the record. Judge Rappaport cited and followed Solitary. I think any trial judge in the state would follow Solitary, would follow Colorado Mills, would follow state of Minnesota, would follow Arellano Avila in any case involving the attempt to reach out into another state, which the state concedes has individual sovereignty, and command on the penalty of sanctions for contempt of court a resident of that state to obey the subpoena. That's the wrong way to go about it in a system of federalism. As this court pointed out in Colorado Mills, if you could reach out, use the long arm statute or some other mechanism to serve a out-of-state non-party subpoena, then why do we have the UIDDA? It would render that act meaningless. The whole system of federalism depends on a balance between the right and power of Colorado to regulate conduct that affects its own citizens and the right of another sovereign state to have the proper procedures, a resident of another sovereign state, to have proper procedures followed to bring in. The UIDDA, just finally, by its terms, defines a subpoena as a document, however denominated, requiring a person, among other things, to produce records. A court order requiring the production would have carried the day. We wouldn't be here. This case would have been over 4 years ago. It would have taken a little bit more footwork on the part of the Attorney General than to do it by contempt. But there was a correct way under our system of laws to accomplish the discovery of those documents. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to thank you, Mr. Lyons, and also you, Mr. Chesson, for your arguments today. The court will take this case under consideration. And I believe our next argument is at 1:30 this afternoon. We'll recess until then. Thank you.